exactly where Sherry left off, was we got to do this faster. We got to be able to get out to the field and empower the ability to do longitudinal evaluations, both in terms of effects, but also into interventional activities. And so this is kind of the trajectory of a little bit of how we kind of got into this disaster research program or project, and based on some of our experiences and a little bit, I might skip over just to give us a little more time for discussion at the end. Again, I have no disclosures since the last time. So our focus, essentially, in terms of the disaster response, so I want to step us up to a macro kind of level for a moment. So in terms of disaster response from the nation, really is focused on the kind of the acute event and really just kind of tailing up what's the impact and trying to move assets kind of quickly and then move on. And we're really trying to think, okay, how do we really recover? How do we really prepare? And how do we get information to kind of change a little bit of this dynamic, which is kind of the original disaster response system was set to do? One thing that's really important to think about and to be cognizant of, and it's one way that we can kind of reach, especially the emergency management group, who kind of goes, you know, we're just here, we do all of our stuff, and you guys want to do research. But it's really the story of the World Trade Center and the fact that had we not looked at the health effects and the World Trade Center responders and people that were involved, we wouldn't have seen this huge amount of post-disaster health sequela, both in terms of sinus, respiratory, mental health, et cetera. And that's one way of like catching the emergency response community. Ah, here you go. We showed you by doing some research. This is really important stuff. And it helps you prepare and helps you understand how important it is to be able to understand what are the health implications and the training and everything else that we're trying to do to help improve our ability to do it safely. You know, one thing that we find that on all these disasters, at least in two categories, in my mind, especially in terms of the environmental health situation, is it safe? People want to know the post-impact, whether going back in their home is and there's mold or whatever the things are. In the case of the oil spill, is it safe? Is it safe for my community? Is it safe for my kids, etc.? And another way of looking at it is, did our strategies work? And Sherry and Sue-Ann were talking about some of the strategies, both in terms of training. How do we evaluate those? How do we do it in a more longitudinal fashion to be able to understand, are we doing it better? Can we keep improving on it and keep making it better? So part, as I was saying, our system is designed really for the acute phase of things. And I'm, for a moment, like to using the oil spill. They had Sentinel hospitals, acute surveillance systems, poison control centers were involved. We got some information about people being affected. NIOSH was doing worker investigations. They did what's called, CDC called CASPER, Community Assessment for Public Health Emergency Response. Community surveys, the bucket brigades, were identifying symptoms in people. Are we setting ourselves up to actually capture this and understand it and use this information in a way that quickly we could begin to move into longitudinal research? And that's the challenge right now. We've been having discussions with CDC and others. How do we put ourselves, identify the cohorts, begin to look at it and implement research-grade information or training, et cetera, in a way that we can use it. So, you know, one thing, as an example, I talked a little bit about the Gulf study before. NIOSH started a worker roster. So people that went into the training program, CHIPS Worker Education Training Program, had responded. NIOSH started a roster, at least to start, here's some people you might want to focus on. Give us a chance to move this, bend this curve up from 11 months. And, Sherry, how long was it until you started the training? It was like a bit after you mentioned it was a bit of a space.
Yeah.
6 months, yeah. So how do we bend that curve forward? So so this was kind of the research responses on the oil spill, using this as just an example. I talked about the Gulf study a little bit this morning already. CHIPS training program, the Worker Education Training Program, was out there doing training for workers involved in the oil spill. Use that as a platform. We also did extramural research, which is actually a really interesting part of the project. I'll come back to that in 1 second. And be able to do toxicology research and then partner with SAMHSA on some longitudinal things. Building, again, off the acute platforms, we do this all the time. The acute response is what's going to happen every time. How do we put ourselves in a position quickly to do longitudinal work and understand the impacts? So the Deepwater Consortium, as opposed to the study, is NIH-funded, 4 universities across the Gulf, Tulane, LSU, University of Florida, University of Texas Medical Branch, and to basically work with the communities, you know, 45 organizations, to come together and identify what was important to them. what's important to your community? What are the health research and issues of concern? Is it with women and pregnant children, cultural ethnic minorities, seafood safety, resiliency, population study, things that they could identify and work with and try to perform important research relevant to the community being impacted. These are the 45 community partnerships that were developed with the academic consortiums and the multiple partners to create actually a network across the Gulf. I mean, you can see these are in different states by colors here, and this is an ongoing network that we can not only learn about the research we're doing, but also put ourselves in a position to have ongoing relationships and opportunities to do further research over time in the Gulf. Just using this as an example of a situation where in West Virginia, folks may remember about a year ago, in January 2014, 10,000 gallons of a chemical MCHM poured into a river there. 300,000 people didn't have water, and we had very little toxicologic information about the chemical that was poured in there, as we do with most chemicals, especially when chemicals are in mixtures. And a situation here where, we really could have, should have been put ourselves an opportunity to understand what were the implications here. We actually are doing some toxicological research now at NIEHS, which is usually a very slow process, and our NTP, the National Toxicology Program, which partners with NIOSH and FDA, are actually working to try to do something quickly here to try to help understand health issues. So when there's situations, at least from the environmental health side of things, we always need to have better information. Every disaster, whether it's the oil spill or World Trade or whatever, has issues, mold and Hurricane Sandy, et cetera, has issues that we need to learn about. And a way of looking at it is, what do we really need to know from the air, water, food, soil, the epidemiology, assessing all the factors and modifiers. How do we put ourselves in this position to begin to get this data? So the challenge has actually been developing over several years in terms of conversations. And some of the things that have been identified, and this was an article that was put out by Francis Collins and Tom Frieden, the director of CDC, and Nikki Lurie, the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response in March 2013, was kind of a challenge of things that needed to be done. And some of those things were, how do we identify what the research questions are quickly? And how do we bring together experts to talk about those research questions quickly? How do we ensure rapid data collection? How do we identify and enumerate those cohorts of concern, the workers and the communities? How do we create scientists and folks to be able to collect information, important information, quickly, and stay out of the way of the emergency response? How do you get it done in an ethically sound way in vulnerable populations, to ensure that you include vulnerable populations that are of concern, that are most sensitive to the impacts of these situations, and also involved infected communities? So we set about a disaster research project, and it was kind of, in a sense, again, off of Hurricane Sandy, and we got the situation of mold again, and we've been looking at mold-related as an issue in disasters for many, many years. And folks wanted to be able to do some more sound work, because what are the real health issues of mold and who's at risk, et cetera, and what should we be doing to actually measure and understand this? And we went back and said, well, where's the questionnaires? Where's the tools and surveys? This happens every time. And NIOSH had some, and ATSDR had some, and we called them up, and we're trying to get things, and they go, this is ridiculous. So how do we make this available? So create accessible data collection tools. Rapid data collection capabilities was another objective of what we're doing. A network was part of the kind of the challenges. How do we use the people we connect with on a more routine basis, not creating something new, but using our relationships in new ways? And then integrate this into kind of the system that I was showing you at the beginning of disaster response, because you have to be integrated in the system. You just show up and say, I'm here to do some research, I'm here to help with worker training. You're not going to be at the table very easily. So what we've done is we started on to create a repository of data collection tools. So CDC's been developing them for years. There's a lot in the literature. We went through about 450 articles and sources, also the stuff that NIH has been creating through the years, and basically put it into a repository along with meta information. So we have about 160 tools from the 450 that were reviewed, and created essentially an available repository of them with some metadata about how was it used, if it was available, What languages does it come in? How many questions, time, etc., literacy about the various tools, etc. And we really want this to be available to the research community. That doesn't really do the federal government any great good, but to the research community in general, in a sense that it's available to anybody to use at any time, because most situations are local. And they're not necessarily big federal responses. It could be just like we had in Texas, again, a recent chemical exposure with 4 or 5 fatalities just this last week. So to create things that are quick, also to try to create opportunities, at least from the federal side, have OMB approval, and also to create an environment where we can move things up on IRB that has institutional review board evaluations. That's been a problem in trying to get research and questions done in a timely way, is getting them through IRB. We're working with our partners at National Library of Medicine, and they have already a disaster research website, but we're created now a disaster, they have disaster websites, so now we created a disaster research website hosting the various tools that we've been working on. So this project's about a year in now, and that website's undergoing transformations. It's available to the public now, and tools are on it. And there's sets of publicly available tools or links to other tools that they can't host on the website, but you can get to the links. 2 more minutes? Okay, I'll make it quickly. So another part of it was trying to create an opportunity to get baseline data. Really difficult to get to a situation quickly and maybe have an opportunity where workers are being trained before they go out, collect some baseline information, not only who they were in terms of a roster, but some baseline health information, maybe even pulmonary function or get biospecimens, etc. And we've developed what's called the RAPID protocol, at least in an intramural capability at NIEHS, to be able to send down a group quickly to be able to get information. And we're working with IRB to actually be able to take what's called the RAPID protocol, which consists of about 36 different tools. And it's kind of a menu-driven thing. So does the situation involve respiratory? Does it involve dermal? Does it involve health and mental health resiliency issues? And then you'd be able to kind of build a tool. And what we're moving toward in the next couple of months is, or hopefully within the next half year or so, is a tool that you'll be able to go on the website and be able to build for yourself. You know, that folks can take and say, I'm really interested in this, but not this and this. And but we're trying to get this RAPID protocol essentially into our IRB. And it's there now, and they're looking at it, and they're also starting to have workshops about, you know, what does it mean to be able to do ethical research in vulnerable populations in disaster situations, and trying to also entertain this discussion about best practices to do that. At the same time, we're trying to push through an opportunity to use tools more rapidly for situations. As part of this is research is really training folks, and to train a research community or stakeholders to be part of this and to be trained not only to use the differing tools, but also to understand the federal response kind of situation that you're involved with. And in terms of showing up and being able to say, here's the FEMA situation and here's the HHS within it and here's what your role is and here's how you can gain access to a site or work with cohorts, et cetera, to be able to understand that and to be able to have site-specific training, health and safety training. So if you're going in and you're going into dangerous environments, you're trained with respect to that and have the right PPE. We did a training exercise in Los Angeles last April with about 140 people, including state health, local county health and individuals. We had academics. We had NGOs and worker groups. And really come together and talking about how do we collect information in a timely way relevant to human health issues, and work together to do it. And the state's typically very, you know, hey, we got it. You know, the emergency manager guys, they know everything. And by the end of the conversation, posing a scenario where a tsunami hit like the port of Los Angeles, which isn't too far-fetched because they had a huge fire there and it was problematic not too long ago, the state basically goes, we get it, and we can't do this, and actually we need to think about doing this together with our academic partners who they don't talk to typically. But they also realized the value of actually coming together, and it was great progress. We're planning another training exercise in Houston in February to further this concept and what we've been trying to develop. And lastly, is we're trying to, again, it goes back to this issue of networks, and we're working with our centers and others to start thinking about how it is to have them help us begin to develop this. So it's not just for us to develop something that's going to be freestanding on a website or tools, et cetera, or concepts of implementing it, but doing it together with the community. Right now we're working and we're starting it up this month, actually, using our NIEHS centers, both in terms of worker training centers, our environmental health core centers, our Superfund centers, our children's centers, to help us start and looking at the various things we've built and actually help us develop it looking forward in a bi-directional fashion, trying to build something for them to use, essentially. Recently, also, part of this is also to have a group of experts around the country that can identify the research questions when situations happen. So pooling from across our groups and other partnerships and NGOs, et cetera, that we've been working with to help us identify the research needs. Recently, we tested an example of this on the Ebola 2 weeks ago. It's a funded part of this that we did with CDC and ASPR, basically saying pulling together experts that we connect with quickly to talk about what are the research needs and gaps and issues up front instead of months into a situation and how do we get that information. Also incorporating the issue of citizen science to generate information back to us and help us understand the exposures within something. So looking forward, and I won't go back through it, I know we're pretty shy on time, but this year we're moving to also working toward including environmental data. How do we get timely environmental data to go with the human health data we've been trying to move forward in collecting? And how do we get toxicology information and data also to kind of simultaneously move forward? So instead of waiting, you know, nine months in the case of Hurricane Sandy to begin research for much of the funded research, 11 months in the Gulf study, trying to create an opportunity to get mirrored environmental tox data and human health information up front. And I leave it at that. And Minecraft is there because it's a game my kid plays, and it's really built by the people that are playing it. And we see this project really is something we're trying to build by the people that are doing it. And everybody is involved, and we really look forward to continuing this interaction and development of this. So thank you. Not fixing the workplace.
But in fact, so there's a whole industry out there, and it is here as well. So you're using the word resiliency training. There's an industry that is doing very bad things. How are you protecting? What do you mean by resiliency, and how are you protecting yourself from that industry that is actually doing bad things?
So I think we're swept up in that as well. And the fact is what is resiliency and what are we referring to? Is it individual resiliency? Is it community resiliency? Is it a workplace resiliency? And I think, you know, different folks are using it in many different ways. We do have a lot of research looking at both community and individual resiliency post-Gulf oil spill in terms of trying to understand, you know, what were the socio and economic and demographic risk factors along with other risk factors and psychosocial stressors for different communities and what's their relationship. I was actually going to ask Sherry and Ann if they had a chance to look at, you know, they mentioned about symptoms, etc., and they mentioned, and they were collecting information about PPE, and I don't know if you guys had a chance to analyze whether certain symptoms were seen, and you had a chance to analyze it in use of PPE, you know, with respect to the cough and some of the other. But that's the kind of things that I think we're kind of meaning in terms of, you know, what do we understand about something, what's protective, what puts people in increased vulnerability. But this conversation is one that we're going to try to continue to push with our research groups, both in terms of Hurricane Sandy and in terms of the Gulf oil spill, because we have so much going on with respect to and trying to pull this together and actually move more toward what are the metrics we're measuring, what do we mean by it, and try to move that conversation forward. So that's been a large part of the conversation that we've been having, a discussion.
Okay. Sherry and then Cora.
Well, I was just going to respond to that. So it's a very good point. And, you know, I think someone could write a whole paper about user terminology. So I'll just tell you from our perspective. So this is what happened. There was actually an Institute of Medicine report that was done that talked about resiliency. And actually in that report, resiliency is defined as a structural thing. You know, how do you build dams?
Right. Absolutely.
Et cetera. But then, you know, they chose this word that has a deep history in mental health, and so it raises a lot of confusion. But then us as researchers, when you want to get money from the federal government, you're kind of stuck using the buzzwords.
Yeah.
You know, when we talked about a resiliency work group, it was very much building the capacity within communities and within the disaster preparedness world to understand what it would take to prevent danger and injury to workers. So I think it is a very, it reminded me very much of like sustainability.
Yeah, exactly. Sustainability is the other one.
But I think resiliency is particularly dangerous because there is this whole wing of it, which I think actually means something very different than the way people are using it now.
Absolutely.
But it can lead to confusion, and particularly for occupational safety and health, because it tends to be associated with, like, you know, well, workers need to be resilient as an individual.
Right.
I'll call your
yeah.
Yeah. So, and so we've taken it, our work group is partially, this immigrant worker disaster resilience work group is partially, like, can we define what we mean by this
right.
as one of the key things we want to accomplish?
Cora, did you have a comment?
Thanks. Along the lines of both preparedness the denormalizing what is going on. I think that it's really clear that we need to prepare for disasters that we know are all coming in a way which brings back what we know, which is that employers are responsible for protecting workers, and that PPE is not the first line of defense in protecting workers. And so part of our task, and I look forward to talking with many of you perhaps over the next year, is how this community can bring back employer accountability, employer capacity to protect workers during disasters with whatever can be done to anticipate to reduce the need for PPE, which is not going to do the job.
Yep.
Jonathan.
I wanted to comment on this issue that Nancy raised, because I think it's really a critical one. And, you know, one of the things that we've learned in doing the pilot projects that Sue Ann was reporting on, a lot of the communities, they weren't just disaster workers. They were also workers who had other traumatic exposures. And that was really interesting because one of the comments was take out the word disaster in front of worker and just use the word worker. Because we had police who, one of the cops, there had been a shooting, and he was told he couldn't even talk to his wife for 30 days, and they had no program in the organization. And that's a very, you know, imagine the traumatic effect of that. There was another story from another cop about a cop who had actually raped and murdered somebody in his uniform in a bank. And this had haunted the department for 8 years. But there were also other workers, make the road. There weren't too many disaster workers, but their disaster experience was living as an immigrant or in the Latino community, job loss, and all these other things. So these psychological impacts, I think, are an under-recognized health effect in the occupational safety and health. create an organizational system, you know, to prevent these incidents. In the case of workplace violence, it would be what happened, how can we prevent that from occurring again? But there is work, including disaster work, where we can anticipate that people are going to be exposed to stresses and trauma. And I just want to emphasize, I think we need to walk on both of those legs, because I've been involved with hundreds of people who've been traumatized, and it can be career-ending and totally disabling. And so we need to help them individually, as well as creating these organizational systems that Nancy was...
An important point that you're kind of going at, too, is, you know, in these disasters, it's very non-traditional work populations. You've got day laborers and volunteers and all sorts of groups. In the case of the oil spill, you had Vietnamese folks who were fishermen. I mean, all sorts of people that are involved in these situations that are now in the middle of something, and how do you basically, you know, get at it, protect them? You know, some of the stuff we could think about, there's always issues that you can't anticipate that are thrust into the middle of it. Well, and as Sherry said, it came out of a whole different thing about infrastructure, kind of resiliency, how strong are our buildings and effective our roads, et cetera.
Okay. So we're at and past, I think, 10 o'clock, and this is a good discussion. So if people want to hang out in the room for a little bit and continue to have it, that's fabulous.
Or take it to the next session.
But I'm going to, or take it to the next roundtable session, which has overlapping themes. In the meantime, I want to thank all of our panelists.